I am informed that there is only one adequate way to introduce the President of the United States, and that is, ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States. And I have come to the conclusion there's only one way to introduce a president of Dallas Seminary, and that is, ladies and gentlemen, the president of Dallas Theological Seminary.
Good for you. Come up, kind of
Yesterday, I had the opportunity to introduce to you Dr. Walvoord, who for a number of years, 34 of his more than 60 years on the campus, he was president of the school, and for more than 40 years, Dr. Campbell has been around, and 8 of those years, he served as president of the school. And ladies and gentlemen, join me in greeting today my predecessor, Dr. Don Campbell. We're glad to have you. If our goal as a seminary is to prepare godly servant leaders for the body of Christ worldwide, it seems to me that we need to be aware of how God trained his servant leaders in biblical times. And among those we would certainly want to be acquainted with would be the man Moses, one of his unique servant leaders. In fact, an early mentor of mine said to me when I was contemplating ministry, if you're thinking seriously about ministry, Chuck, you need to make a serious study of Moses. He was right, and I have done that, and I continue to do that. I've also observed, having done so and continuing to do so, that many who have not made a study of Moses have misperceptions about the man. Many people on the street have faulty impressions of Moses, having gotten their cues from Hollywood. They think he was born a beautiful baby, grew up to look like Charlton Heston. He had an early cruise on the Nile. He became an overnight success with millions of people to lead. And you and I know that none of the above is true. Serious students of Moses know that the man for 40 years of his life was a pathetic example of a leader. It is true that he was in his mother's arms until he was weaned, and he was in the court of Pharaoh throughout his teenage years. And if Josephus is right, he was the Pharaoh elect, the one in the Pharaoh's mind to become his successor. But as you know who are studying the scriptures, this man at the age of 40 blew it royally. He murdered an Egyptian and he hid him to cover up the fact of his deed. But he was found out and he escaped. And according to the scriptures, he sat down by a well in probably the lowest moment of his life and realized that those first 40 years had been virtually spent in vain. I'm probably not the first to point out that by the time he reached the age of 80, he had made 3 of the most common mistakes in ministry. First is the mistake of intensity, which is what I would call running before he was sent. Second was the mistake of insecurity, and that was retreating after he had failed. I came across a great quote of Churchill: success is going from failure to failure without loss of enthusiasm. Moses hadn't learned that, even by the age of 40. When he failed, he sat down and retreated. And then of all things, when he was called by God through the burning bush in Exodus chapter 3, you remember that he was reluctant. And that I would call the problem of inferiority, resisting when he was called. It was an act not simply of inferiority, but of absolute resistance to the will of God. That burning bush was a disappointment, at least early on, but finally God has his way, as he always will. One wag tells the apocryphal story of the death of President George Bush, who, when he stands before Peter at the pearly gates, is welcomed in with a question: "Is there anyone you'd like to meet?" Bush says, "Yes, I would like very much to meet Moses, a man I've respected throughout my time as president and even before, a great leader." Peter seeks the presence of Moses, and when he finds him, he tells him of the president's desire to talk with him, and Moses responds, "No way. Last time I talked to a Bush, I got 40 years. Anybody who knows the story of Moses realizes that those 40 years that followed his 80th birthday were for him the best years of his life, and in many ways the hardest. What a task to lead those Hebrews in the wilderness. And I really believe that the reading of Numbers and certainly Deuteronomy would be great preparation for anyone seriously thinking about ministry. And anyone interested in leadership certainly ought to do that. My Bible is open to Exodus chapter 12, where the story really begins for the last of the third segment of his life. He has been through the plagues with the Hebrews, and now God has his way in setting the people free. The Exodus is about to occur. Moses is about to lead them out of Egypt and onto the promised land of Canaan. We read in verse 40 of Exodus chapter 12, "The time that the sons of Israel lived in Egypt was 430 years. And it came about at the end of 430 years to the very day that all the hosts of the Lord went out from the land of Egypt." In the margin of my Bible, I've written simply the Exodus. They leave after 400 plus years. They leave having never lived in the wilderness. They leave as a body of people who had been brick makers and masons of various sorts and serving under the taskmasters of Pharaoh. They leave knowing nothing of wilderness life. And they leave under the leadership of Moses. The Lord said to Moses in verse 43, "This is the observance of the Passover. No foreigner is to eat of it." And he goes on to describe the involvements of the Passover. And then Moses goes with the memory in his mind of God's marvelous provision as he delivered the people there from Egypt and then later through the Red Sea. Magnificent miracle in the account of the scriptures. And when you get over to the book of Numbers, Numbers chapter 13, you come to another part of Moses' struggles with the people. The spies are sent into the land to scout it out. They come back with a divided report. 12 went in, 10 came back saying, "No way." 2 came back, namely Joshua and Caleb, saying, "God is well able to give us the land." The people believed the majority. One wonders if Toynbee isn't right when he says, "It is doubtful the majority has ever been right." The majority had their way and won the people's hearts, and by chapter 14, all the congregation, here is Moses the leader, listening to this response of the people, they lifted up their voices and they cried, and the people wept that night, and all the sons of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron, and the whole congregation said to them, "Would that we had died in the land of Egypt. Would that we had died in the wilderness." We who lead congregations must get used to grumbling. And we must also realize that often the blame will fall on us when we have actually had nothing to do with the problems people are going through. Like today, back then they looked for a scapegoat. The closest and the biggest target was Moses, so they blamed him. And now they blame the Lord, verse 3. Why is the Lord bringing us into this land to fall by the sword? Our wives and our little ones will become plunder. Would it not be better for us to return to Egypt? And you may even live to hear words like verse 4. They said to one another, let's appoint a leader and return to Egypt. We need another pastor. We need another leader. We need somebody who will make us comfortable. Somebody who will take away our pain. A lot of things are written about leadership, and many of them are pretty unrealistic. The scriptures will always lead you into a realistic understanding of servant leadership. And here is a wonderful case in point. You will be blamed for things you didn't do. You will be misquoted. You will be misunderstood. You will at times even experience being run off. I have a friend who graduated before I got out of seminary, and after a few years in a particular ministry in these United States, got back in touch with me, and I said, how are things there? He said, well, they actually ran me off. I said, really? What happened? He said, well, I referred to the Lord's table as the Eucharist, and that night they fired me. I was as quiet as you are, trying to figure out, did I understand that correctly? But several board members had a thing on that particular word, and because of their background and hang up with that word that he used, we've had enough of this man. And I'm sure there was little more to the story than the use of the word Eucharist, but it sometimes hangs on a wire that thin. Moses is, they now talk of replacing him. The next scene we find in this exciting account of leadership is in Numbers chapter 21, where I want to spend the bulk of our time. Numbers 21. As you know, the result of that majority decision was that the people were then judged by the Lord. He told Moses that the older generation would die off, and there would only be left a new generation to enter the land of Canaan. Aside from Joshua and Caleb, the two faithful spies, the people would go into the land as younger men and women. And they would begin a new life in Canaan. All of the older ones that had believed the words of the majority of the spies would die in the wilderness. So Moses is leading them through the wilderness, and it is one difficult experience after another. Realistically, it isn't fun. It isn't exciting. Oh, there are moments. How thrilling it must have been when manna was delivered. Psalm 78 calls it angel's food. God delivered every day fresh food. But the people didn't like that. They got tired of that after a while. I remember sitting in Dr. Pentecost's class years ago, and he made the comment when referring to the people not wanting manna. He said, it takes a heavenly appetite to enjoy a heavenly food, and they lacked that. These people had a carnal appetite. They wanted meat. Remember the story? God said, you want meat? I mean, he gave them meat up to their, well, let's say their chins. They had meat all over the place. They got sick of that. Their hearts were wrong, so their attitudes were sour. Now look at the scene in verse 4 of Numbers chapter 21, especially you who were seriously thinking about ministry. Then they set out from Mount Hor by the way of the Red Sea to go around the land of Edom. And the people became impatient because of the journey. I would imagine if you have ever been to that land, you can understand how difficult it must have been to to walk it. Back in 1964, my sister gave me a book that to this day I really treasure. It's one of those big coffee table books called God's Wilderness. And it's page after page of rather boring reading to the outsider. Page after page of rather boring pictures. It's the wilderness. Very near and perhaps an exact part of the places where they had walked. In one page of the book, we read that this wilderness was nothing more than vast plains of gravel. Endless expanses of undulating sand dunes, great depressions, and high jutting mountains. By far, the greater part of the territory is practically barren. Such vegetation as there is being of the typically desert kind, meager and monotonous. If you have been in such wilderness, you know there isn't even a sprig of grass. To say nothing of a struggling bush fighting for life. These people were in that kind of wilderness, and they wearied of the journey. And such thoughts and experiences accompanied them day after day after day. And these tenderfoot Hebrews weren't ready for it. And so they decided it's time to grumble again. The people spoke against God and Moses. Why have you brought us up out of Egypt to die in the wilderness? That's quite an indictment. God brought them up to die? This, even some of the younger ones perhaps were complaining here. There is no food, no water, and we loathe this miserable food. Sounds like talk in the seminary cafeteria, doesn't it? We loathe this food. There's no food. There's no water. We hate this food. Harsh as it may sound for me to say it, you will have to get used to people's complaining. It's part of the occupational hazard of ministry life. They will fuss about this. They will gripe about that. They will whine about you, and they will bellyache about, oh, the music. They'll complain about the preaching. The lighting is poor. The sound system is weak. The pews are hard. The air conditioning isn't cool enough, or it's too cold. One lady in our church, no matter where she sat, it was too cold. I suggested they have her sit outside, and she could then be warm. Sermons are too long. Pipe organ is too loud. You talk too much about money. The place isn't friendly, or you're too friendly. I heard that one time. The bulletins are printed too small, or there's too many of them, or there isn't enough of them. Gripe, gripe, gripe. There's a little children's song that our kids sang on the children's choir. It's called Grumblers. In country, town, or city, some people can be found who spend their lives in grumbling at everything around. Yeah, they grumble no matter what we say, for they are chronic grumblers, and they grumble night and day. This guy isn't a great poet, but he gets the point across. They grumble on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, grumble on Thursday too, grumble on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, grumble the whole week through. He's got 5 verses in that song, and he doesn't even begin to touch on all the things they grumble about. They just grumble. They just grumble. This was Moses' moment to say, I've had it with you clods. That's it. But he doesn't do that. Remarkable. That's why I say it's worth a study of Moses. They spoke against him. They spoke against God. But the Lord said, in effect, that's enough. Now it gets real interesting. I like scenes like this. Major part of the reason is I wasn't there, so I can enjoy it objectively. And the Lord sent fiery serpents, some kind of desert viper, potent, poisonous bite was sent. These snakes were sent among them. And they bit the people so that many people of Israel died. That's a great time for me to just kind of candidly let you know another side of my life. I hate snakes. To make matters worse, I have friends who have them as pets. One of the members of our staff, Gary Richmond in Fullerton at the Free Church in Fullerton, worked for 8 years in the Los Angeles Zoo. We used to say he had the best training for ministry of anybody on the staff. Gary never met an animal he didn't like. And he would stop his car on the road and catch snakes and put them in pillowcases and then tie them up. And you know, his wife, a remarkable person, she never got bit. She lived with the stuff writhing in the corner and stuff moving around in pillowcases. To this day, when I get in bed at night, I kind of feel around to make sure that everything is safe. Snakes. And then I come across little pieces like I read in the Dallas Morning News this morning. Maybe you read this. A man whose 8-foot pet python coiled itself around his neck was rescued by his sister. Now, stay with me through this. This is an interesting story. She heard his screams and then cut off the snake's head with a butcher knife. Now, that's a fun way to start a day, isn't it? Just think about it. The snake sprang up and bit 28-year-old Timothy Sickles on the cheek after he opened the top of its tank to give it a drink on Monday. It curled around his neck and as it hung onto Sickles' face, police said. Sickles' sister, Mary, cut off the python's head. When the snake would still not let go, she cut off another chunk of its body, which fell to the floor and slithered under a bed. That's a snake with no head, still slithering. I mean, there's a sick people that have snakes like that. That's a kind of person that would bungee jump on a rubber band or, you know, skydive with an umbrella. These are weird people. And it says this thing was still hanging on to his face, and she pulled the head off her brother's face. Sickles suffered swelling on his face. Well, I would imagine he would be swelling on his face. These are snakes. And they're all over the place. And they're killing people. And all of a sudden, God gets their attention. This is Moses' great moment. I mean, if there is anything in Moses by way of a retaliatory attitude, this is his chance to just fold his arms and say, there's just nothing I could do about it. You know, those things happen. But he doesn't do that. Many of the people died, so the people came to Moses and said, we have sinned because we have spoken against the Lord. I have a saying I have used for years, that pain plants the flag of reality in the fortress of a rebel heart. And I'll tell you, it did that day. You heard enough, you watch enough folks around you die, and you drop to your knees. And they pled for mercy. We have sinned against the Lord and you. I love the order. Sinning against him is nearly as significant as sinning against their Lord. And they acknowledge both. And they said, intercede with the Lord that he may remove the serpents from us. Now, this is his moment. You know, everything in his old nature would say, you know, in your face. You cursed him. Now you work your way out of this. And there will be moments in leadership when you will bite your tongue, because the very ones who spoke against you will come back to you on their knees needing your help. And you will find yourself calling on God for grace to administer mercy rather than revenge. And there's not a bit of that revenge in Moses. It's beautiful. We just read a simple sentence, Moses interceded for the people. And by the way, that is one of the most significant roles you play as a leader, where you intercede for the people. He went before his God, and whatever it was he prayed, it was effective. The Lord said to Moses, make a fiery serpent and set it on a standard. And it shall come about that everyone who is bitten, when he looks at it, he shall live. Remarkable plan. This had never been done before. It would never be done again. That's exactly what he did. Moses made a bronze serpent and set it on the standard, and it came about that if the serpent bit any man, that when he looked to the bronze serpent, he lived. What a simple plan. You're in a tent. The snake is in the tent. Bitten. You're bitten by the snake. And all you have to do is look at that serpent that's up on the standard. Just look. And when they did, they lived. Isn't God handle things in a wonderful manner? No one who looked failed to be healed, relieved. They looked, they lived. In John chapter 3, our Lord Jesus, centuries later, in speaking with Nicodemus about life eternal, said in verse 14 of John 3, as Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, even so must the Son of Man be lifted up. Jesus, the master illustrator, picks the one occasion when a bronze serpent is made in the wilderness, and he uses this as an analogy for the Son of Man being lifted up on that cross to come. At this moment in his life, it is yet before him, but he says, as Moses once lifted up the serpent, even so must the Son of Man be lifted up, that whoever believes in him may have eternal life. Magnificent, simple plan, and we rest the whole case of the gospel on John 3, 14 through 16, that whoever believes in him would never perish but have everlasting life. No wonder that continues to be the watershed of theology. No wonder people still fight over whether it is that simple or that full of grace or not. You telling me all I have to do is believe and I live? That's exactly what he says. As Moses lifted up the serpent, even so must the Son of Man be lifted up. By believing in God's simple plan, there is relief, there is life, there is eternal assurance of a hope with God. Isn't that great? But you know, there's another mention of this old snake in the scriptures. 2 Kings chapter 18. Turn back there. We jump far ahead. Let's go back in time a little closer. Well, we're still a long ways away. We're, if I figure correctly, over 750 years from the original serpent in the wilderness. Time has passed. Centuries have come and gone. Interesting thing happened in the reign of Hezekiah regarding this old snake. It came about in the third year of Hoshea, 2 Kings 18 begins, the son of Elah, king of Israel, that Hezekiah, the son of Ahaz, king of Judah, became king. He was 25 years old when he became king, and he reigned 29 years in Jerusalem. Verse 3, he did right in the sight of the Lord according to all that his father David had done. He removed the high places and broke down the sacred pillars and cut down the Asherah. Now watch closely. He also broke in pieces the bronze serpent that Moses had made. Did you know that that was in the scriptures? 775 years after it had been made, he broke in pieces the bronze serpent that Moses had made, for until those days the sons of Israel burned incense to it, and it was called Nehushtan. Do you know that verse was in the Bible? I remember the day I found that and sort of whooped it up in the study. I thought, what an interesting observation. Tucked away in the folds of the old 2 Kings scroll is the story of this old serpent. And what is it? These people had turned it into a fetish. It had long since served its purpose. They were to go on past it. It had been useful for its time, and now they were to go on beyond it. No way. Being idolaters by nature, they chose to make it into more than it was ever meant to be. Until those days, they burned incense to it. They're now worshiping the snake of all things. And it was called, I think Hezekiah gave it the name, Nehushtan. Interesting play on words. Nakash for serpent. Nekosheth for bronze. Just a piece of bronze. That's all it was. It had served its purpose. It was never meant to be worshipped. It was to be an analogy in the centuries to come when Christ was raised on the cross. But it had no place in there as a shrine. By worshiping the symbol instead of embracing the reality of its meaning, we lose our way. Maybe it's a twist, or maybe it's a reach for me to apply it in this area, but seminary has its purpose. But seminary was never meant to be a shrine. God has raised it up. God is using it. God will use it in your life, all of your lives in some way. But it's a place to get through, acknowledge, derive its benefit, and then get on with your ministry. It isn't a museum. In itself, it is no sacred place. But it has its sacred purposes. And when we come with the right motive and heart to it and bring those things to this place, then it's serving that purpose. And beyond that, it's just a piece of bronze. What am I saying? I'm saying this, students, and I speak especially now to you who are students. So much of what you get out of seminary will depend upon what you put into it. We don't do magic around here. We don't wave wands and create teachable minds. That's your job. You bring that to the table. We don't bring willing hearts and obedient desires. We come as faculty to model, to minister, to love, to serve, to challenge, if you will, to test, to grade, to guide, to counsel. But it's what you bring to it that will make it significant. And if the truth were known, it won't be long before some of you, if you're not careful, will fall into the category of the grumblers. Grumbling about this and grumbling about that, and you'll miss the whole purpose as you find people or situations to blame. In my reading this past summer, I came across a work entitled The Naturalist by Harvard graduate Edward Wilson. In it, I found a fabulous statement. What counts heavily in the shaping of a scientist is the accessibility and approval of the faculty. What is truly decisive, however, is the desire and ability of the student. Otherwise, failure awaits, regardless of the learning environment, and no excuse can be made for it. If you are a lousy hunter, the woods are always empty. If you are a lousy student, your studies are nothing more than a piece of brass. And they will make little difference in your life. I'd like us to pause for prayer and bow our heads and close our eyes. And faculty and staff and student and friend alike, I'd like us to find ourselves somewhere in the text of this passage we've read, these scriptures that have been the basis of our words today. There's something for each one of us. And so, Lord, as you take what we have heard and as you use it in significant ways, as we begin our work at this school, I pray that you will find within us hearts of Joshua and Caleb, the mercy of a Moses, the compassion of the Savior with a Pharisee. Late at night. And I pray, Father, as time runs its course and the weeks turn into months and the studies get tough and the days get monotonous, I pray that you will guard our hearts from the temptation to grumble, to find reasons to blame, to search for someone else as the excuse for our sloth or just rank carnality. Our Father, it's what we bring to this place that makes the classroom exciting and significant. More importantly, it is the presence of the Spirit of God who moves among our ranks and ignites us with zeal for the things of God. May this semester find your heart rejoicing, not grieving, delighted over what we bring in praise and worship and openness to the things we are taught. Be glorified, our Father, through Jesus Christ, I ask this, and everyone said,